Tonight we will be in Isaiah 36 and 37. It's an interesting thing when you look into Isaiah 36 and 37. I don't know if your Bible has poetry written as poetry, but you'll notice in these chapters 36 to 39 of Isaiah, there's only a couple of small portions of poetry in them. That means they're mostly prose. What that means is they're stories. They're storytelling. Poetry is another way to tell stories, and much of what was in the prophets is actually poetry, and it's very, very beautiful poetry. It's actually, in terms of literature, especially Isaiah, is fabulous, really fabulous. But when we get into prose sections, we immediately plug into storytelling, and that's exactly what's going on in this particular section. As we look at this, I'd like to have you hold your place here and turn back with me to a passage from Isaiah 7. Which took place, same prophet, Isaiah, different king, man by the name of Ahaz, Isaiah 7. And Ahaz was under a lot of pressure. This will make sense in a minute when you'll see we'll talk about his son Hezekiah in the narrative we're going to look at this evening. Ahaz is under a lot of pressure from some armies to the north, and he's made a bad deal with the Assyrians in order to get them off his back. Ahaz is not a godly man, the king Ahaz, not a godly man. Isaiah comes to Ahaz, and he says, you need to trust God. I'm giving you the really, really brief rendition of this. He says, you need to trust God. And the Lord tells him, look at verse 3 of chapter 7. The Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and your son, Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. Now, that was a place outside the city where you could meet. And he went out there. That's where Ahaz was looking at what was going on and was kind of frightened by the circumstances. Verses 4 to 9, Isaiah says, you need to trust me more than you fear your enemies. Ahaz doesn't do it. And in the process of saying no to Isaiah and to the Lord, Ahaz receives a most amazing promise, the promise of the Christ child. This promise was given at this place at a time when the king was under huge pressure. And the king in this case simply said, no, I won't trust God. Now that becomes, you know, when we celebrate Christmas as we're about to, we only read, or if we read at all from this section, we only read the part about the child who will come in verse 14. The Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she'll call his name Emmanuel. We know that that means God with us, and this becomes this marvelous sign fulfilled in Christ Jesus. What people don't understand sometimes or don't connect with is that this incredibly wonderful promise was given against the backdrop of a faithless king at a very dark time when all the pressure was on him and he refused to trust God. And God said, listen, you may refuse to trust me, but that does not mean I am untrustworthy. And I will keep my promises to my people. You're just going to miss out on it, he says to Ahaz. But take note where it takes place. Just outside the city, at a place called the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. Now, let's go to Isaiah 36. Isaiah 36 to 39 is about Hezekiah. And if you read ahead, then you may be slightly confused because actually these events take place a generation later than what we just read in chapter 7, but they are about a man named Hezekiah, who's the son of Ahaz, the irresponsible and faithless king who said no to Isaiah. And if you read ahead, you see several exciting stories that take place here. In chapter 36, Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. In chapter 37, the Lord delivers them from the armies. In chapter 38, Hezekiah is healed from a fatal illness, probably some sort of infection. And chapter 39, Hezekiah shows all of his treasures to a Babylonian magistrate who comes to visit him. Now, we'll see all of these as we go through in the weeks to come. But if you read all these, and I'm sure you did, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, you should know something. And I'll tell you this now, then I'll repeat it again in a couple of weeks when we get back into this section. Chapter 38 and 39 actually happened before chapters 36 and 37. Doesn't that just torque you? When you read the Bible, and we're just like really good Americans and Westerners, you know, and we're always thinking, well, everything's done in chronological order. And then you study the Bible, you find out it's not in chronological order. The books aren't it, except Genesis is the beginning and Revelation is the end. But everything in between, it's like not in chronological order at all. Well, the reason is that these historians these prophets actually, as historians, were much more interested in the theme they were talking about than in the chronology of it. They cared more about the moral of the story than they did about which thing happened first. And we always care about the other. And so you have to bear that in mind. And sometimes you will come to accounts, especially prophetic kinds of things, where the author has deliberately put the material in a particular way. And he knows that it's not in chronological order, but he doesn't care because it's a thematic arrangement of the material. He's talking about themes here. And so you find this in Isaiah. The first half of the book of Isaiah is about how God says, don't trust Assyria and don't trust the nations around you and don't be a pagan and do trust me. I mean, that's the bottom line of the first half of the book of Isaiah. Could have been a lot shorter book, huh? When you pull it out and you look at it, and so that's why Isaiah takes chapters 36 and 37, which are about Assyria, and he puts them in front of the events that happen in chapters 38 and 39, he just inverts them. They all happen within about 3 years of each other. But he inverts the order. The reason is he wants to finish the story about Assyria. 36 and 37 are about Assyria. And he wants to finish the moral of the story of the first half of the book. God says, don't trust Assyria. God says, he's in charge of history. God says, trust him and not the world around you. Bottom line, first half of Isaiah. And so to make that case, Isaiah doesn't care about the chronology. He takes the account of Sennacherib, who's the Assyrian king, we'll read about him, and he moves it in front. The second half of the book of Isaiah, actually the backdrop is Babylon. And the Babylonians are introduced in this event that takes place where Hezekiah is introduced to Merodach-Baladan, who we will meet in a couple of weeks. And feel free to name your kids any of these names. Merodach-Baladan, a Babylonian king, a Babylonian upstart, really. He's a renegade at the time. And we're introduced to him in 38 and 39. And so Isaiah wants that to start the second half of the book. He wants Babylon as the backdrop, and he wants to finish the first half of the book with Assyria. So he takes these two events, and he inverts them on purpose, okay? So bear that in mind as we go through it. Chapter 36, what's going on here is that Hezekiah is a godly king. He is the son of Ahaz, who is a terribly ungodly man. You know, it might surprise you to know how many godly people are born into ungodly families. Isn't that odd? When I was in youth ministry many, many eons ago, so sad how long ago that was. You know, my kids in my youth group are actually having kids and grandkids. How does that happen? Anyway, when I was back in youth ministry, one of the strongest young men in our whole ministry, every night when he went home, he took flack from his parents for being a Christian. I'm serious. They ragged on him. His whole family ragged on him. He was about 16 years old. And you talk about no support for your faith in your home life. And yet this young guy was as strong as an ox spiritually. I mean, when he got converted, he got thoroughly converted. And he was there at everything. He really understood the principle that your family is the body of Christ. You know, he understood it. And I think a lot of times that is that way. When a person is in an environment that they know is very much anti-God, and then they hear about the Lord, and then they are converted, they feel so different than the rest of their history. And they're enthused by this difference. And that is as it should be, actually. That is conversion. That's a wonderful thing. That's the way Hezekiah was. When he took over from his father Ahaz, he took over a kingdom that was in shambles spiritually, and financially, it was doing okay, but spiritually, it was in shambles, and politically, it was in a very great danger. The Assyrians, Ahaz had made a deal with the Assyrians up north to save his own skin, basically, and God had told him not to. The same main prophet was Isaiah for both these guys, and the prophet Isaiah had told Ahaz not to do it, and Ahaz had done it anyway. Ahaz was a faithless, idolatrous man, worshipped all kinds of different gods, brought in statues and all kinds of monuments to all the different gods, put them right into the temple area. He had sacrifices being made to all kinds of pagan gods. They were doing human sacrifices, sacrificing babies in Israel during Ahaz's time. It was a terrible thing, a terrible debauchery spiritually. When Hezekiah took over, he said, I am going to make some changes. And he made some major changes. He reigned for about 42 years. The first few years, it was in co-regency with his father. As he watched his father do everything and determined all the way along, I'm not going to do it this way when I become king. When his dad finally died, young Hezekiah took over, and he made major, major changes all throughout Israel. In his 42-year reign, Israel experienced essentially, at least on the surface, and it didn't go all the way to the soul for the next generation anyway, but at least for this generation on the surface, it was a major revival. He reformed Judah, rebuilt the temple, destroyed the pagan idol worship centers, reinstituted real worship as the state religion of Israel, which is what it was supposed to be. Hezekiah was the one in whose reign they found the book of the law hidden in the rubble in the temple. And they brought it out and read it, and he was so crushed by this, and he said, we're changing. We're making major changes. That's Hezekiah. Wonderful, wonderful guy. He also reneged on his dad's promise to Assyria, and this caused a real problem. Assyria was having a big problem with their king. They were shifting kings. And whenever the major king of the major superpower either died, they usually got killed, actually. And that was how they had their elections. And then the new king would take over, and there would always be a period of weakness in which the new king was solidifying his empire. And that gave you about 2 or 3 year window. If you wanted to rebel, now's the time. Well, that's what happened in Assyria. And Hezekiah, who hated the Assyrians because they were such idolaters, and they were allies of his father, and they had been the ones who designed the stinking little altar that his dad brought down and stuck into the temple area. I mean, this is all the stories, you know, I could tell you stories, right? And he says, I hate those guys. So as soon as they have problems up in Assyria, he says, well, we're not paying you anymore. And he had some help with this. There were some upstart Babylonians who also hated the Assyrians. They said that they would get behind this. The Egyptians also didn't like the Assyrians. They said, yeah, we'll get behind this too. And then a bunch of other folks in that area, they all said the same thing. Yeah, we'll stop paying the Assyrians. So for a few years, Hezekiah had a fairly good time of it, and he was really serving the Lord. The Lord was with him in almost everything he did, except one thing. He was never rebuked for this, but there was a huge pressure in Israel to make better and better friends with the Egyptians just in case the Assyrians really came on strong after him. So he kept that going. There was a large contingent of people who wanted the Egyptians as their friends. Isaiah the prophet was kind of a stabilizing factor in this whole thing. Isaiah said, you're right to be serving the Lord. You're right to be reinstituting this religion. You're right to be doing all these things. Your heart is right with God. But by the way, don't trust the Egyptians. If you're making a deal with the Egyptians, that's fine, but you're going to lose your money because they will not be able to bail you out if the Assyrians come down. Isaiah said this consistently. Hezekiah may have believed Isaiah. We don't know. I tend to think he did because they were pretty close. I think he believed Isaiah, but you can believe one person and still make a decision against what they think you ought to do for other reasons. Have you ever done that? Believed a person, know full well they're telling you the truth, then make a decision against them? Well, that's what Hezekiah did. Now, in doing that, he stopped paying Assyria, made a deal with the Egyptians, or let his magistrates do it. He set up something that is going to come back to bite him and really make a major challenge of his faith. He will be another king, the son of Ahaz, and that person will have a similar decision to make to what Ahaz had to make. We'll see how it works. By the way, incidentally, he had also rebuilt Jerusalem militarily, dug a huge cave, long tunnel, 1,750-foot tunnel through solid rock. He had his engineers dig it from both sides and meet in the middle. Figure that out. In those days, to get the water from the Gihon spring all the way into the pool of Siloam so that if they had a siege, he knew they were coming. If they had a siege, they had a water source inside the city, very important. Built extra walls, really fortified everything. He did all that stuff. So what happens is at about 701, the Assyrians do finally come and they head down to Jerusalem. And what they've done, by the time we get into chapter 36, what they've done is, it's the year 701, and it's pretty accurate. Some dates aren't, but this is pretty accurate. 701 BC. They had come all the way down. They went to the coast, came down, and wiped out, just like this gigantic wave, a tsunami of violence, just wiped out every city, every walled city in the whole kingdom all around Israel, went down to Lachish, which was their last major fortified city on the road to Egypt, and besieged Lachish. Now, the situation is this. The army of the Assyrians has surrounded Lachish, and it's taken a while to take the city, okay, because it's got troops in it, it's got walls, and a siege took time. Meanwhile, they only had a certain number of months in which to do war. I don't know if you knew that or not. They had to do it during good weather, so there's always springtime when they would start, and by the time the rain started in the fall, they had to be done. If you didn't finish your siege, you needed to get it done quick. And multiple year sieges were okay, but boy, they were expensive. So he has Lachish. Sennacherib is the king of Assyria, and he's trying to get Lachish. And he's thinking, man, Jerusalem's up here. It's very heavily fortified. Lachish is down here. If I could get Jerusalem to cave in and give up, if I could scare them bad enough, pile up a bunch of skulls out in front of their door, that's what those guys did. Maybe if they gave up, I could get Lachish. So what he does is he sends a sizable contingent of his army up to Jerusalem and surrounds the city, and his main field commander. And his main field commander meets three of Hezekiah's main guys and threatens them. Now, Hezekiah is in a very tough spot because everybody around him has already fallen. The way the Assyrians came down, they came down the coastline, wiped everything else out, and essentially isolated Jerusalem in the hills. Jerusalem's up in the hills. It is a tough city to take. And so he came down and he took everything else. Then he sends this guy up. While he's fighting Lachish, he sends this guy up to deal with Hezekiah. And the guy that goes up there tries to intimidate Hezekiah and the entire city, tries to demoralize the city. Moral of the story, he's trying to make the people of Jerusalem who've recommitted their lives to the Lord, I almost said to Christ, actually it is, sort of. He's trying to make them stop trusting God at this particular moment. And Hezekiah is also having, in his own mind, all the doubts. I should have never done this. What am I going to do now? Lord, look at where I'm at. I've tried to serve you, and now I'm surrounded, and I don't know what to do. That's the scene. Okay? Chapter 36. It came about in the 14th year of Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh, is the Hebrew word. The NIV renders it his main field commander. Probably the NIV is right. It's a title rather than a proper name. From Lachish to Jerusalem. See, Lachish was under siege. Sennacherib sends Rabshakeh, or the commander, up to Jerusalem, to King Hezekiah with a large army. And he stood by the, well, very interesting, the conduit of the upper pool on the highway of the Fuller's Field. Now, this is not to be lost on people who know this and read this. You should make this connection. You had a king last generation who stood on the same spot. And God said, trust me more than you fear your enemies. And that king said, no, I will not trust you. And God said, well, I will be faithful anyway, and you're just going to lose out. Now you have his son standing on the same spot, or at least his official standing on the same spot, making a very similar decision. Do you ever notice how in every generation, every one of us eventually has to come to the same spots? Learn from previous generations' mistakes. Anyway, that's where this takes place. Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna, the scribe, Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. Now, what Hezekiah is doing is Hezekiah is saying, I don't talk to the field commanders. I will only talk to Sennacherib. So he sends his commanders to talk to Sennacherib's commanders. That's the way it was done, diplomatically. So the field commander in verse 4 says to them, listen, you do go tell Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria. What is this confidence that you have? I say your counsel and your strength for the war are empty words. On whom do you rely that you've rebelled against me? He's speaking directly for his king. Behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans on it, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. In other words, you made a deal. They had good espionage. We know you made a deal with the Egyptians. Who cares? The Egyptians are not going to bail you out of this. And this is frightening. Actually, the Egyptians didn't bail them out. They came up, got into a skirmish, and went back home. And so that's what this guy's saying. What are you doing trusting the Egyptians? Verse 7. If you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God. And this is the name for God, by the way. He uses the name Yahweh. He knows the name. He knows the covenant name. If you trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and has said to Judah and to Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar? Interesting. Interesting that he knew that this had happened. And you know what else is interesting? What's he saying? What's his logic? You shouldn't trust Yahweh. Why? Well, because your king has insulted Yahweh by taking down all those extra altars. Did that really insult the Lord? Absolutely not. He was obeying the Lord when he did that. But see, this commander doesn't understand the covenant at all. He thinks that he can intimidate Israel by telling them that Hezekiah has insulted their God. He's treating the real God just like a pagan god, like one of the Assyrian gods. You can't get away from your own theology, by the way. And he has a pagan theology. So he just puts it into his argument as he tries to intimidate these guys. Now, therefore, come make a bargain with my master. This is facetious. It's ironic. The king of Assyria. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you're able to put riders on them. How then can you repulse one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? And have I now come up without the Lord's approval against this land to destroy it? Again, he uses the Lord's name. The Lord said to me, go up to this land and destroy it. Now, this is a pretty heavy thing. These guys come out, and Hezekiah has told them, do not answer whatever this commander says. And there's this huge army standing there of guys who just like to walk up and cut your head off. And here, you're the diplomat. And you walk out there and have this powwow with this guy who's speaking the language of all the people who are listening behind you in Jerusalem. And his logic is, you can't stand against us. Look at what he has said. First of all, he says, basically, in verses 4 and 5, get real. You can't stand against Assyria alone. True or false? True or false? Good, we're about split. I love that. That's a good discussion. It's true. It's true. They couldn't stand against Assyria alone. Now, Lee pointed out they're not actually alone, but Assyrians don't know that, and half the Israelis don't know that. So you're standing there, and the invisible God is with you, and you're looking actually for something a bit more visible if that would be okay with him. Have you ever noticed that? You know, I know you're going to come through, Lord. I'd like a little cash in my account. Would that be all right? Okay. But so this is a powerful point. Get real. What do you think you're doing? You're the last city in the whole area, and we have slaughtered thousands of people and broken down all these powerful cities, and we're going to come get you too. Very intimidating. Secondly, Egypt won't be a help to you. True or false? True. True, Egypt was not going to be a help. And furthermore, Isaiah even said Egypt wouldn't be a help. Hezekiah would hear this and he would remember, I know, that's what Isaiah told me too. You know, you got these conflicts going on in this guy Isaiah. He's a godly man who got pressured into something he probably knew was wrong. And now he's hearing Isaiah's voice saying, yeah, it was a dumb thing to do anything with the Egyptians. Now, that's true. The Egyptians weren't going to help. Number three, the third piece of logic, God won't help you because Hezekiah has insulted him by taking down his altars. Did you see that? Is that true or false? That's false. When he starts to impugn God, he slips out of truth and into falsehood. He's said some true things, but now that's not true. You know, Hezekiah had actually honored God by doing this, and this fellow didn't understand the covenant. The fourth thing he says is, we have horses. If I were even to give you some, you wouldn't know what to do with them. That's basically what he's saying. I could give you 2,000 horses. You wouldn't have enough riders to put on them. And even if you had enough riders to put on them, there's no way you could stop us and our chariots. We do this for a living. And you dumb Hebrews are up here. You don't know how to ride horses, and you don't know how to use chariots. True or false? That's true. They did not know how to use chariots. They lived in the hills, and chariots are not much good in hills. They need the Shephelah, the foothills and the valleys. They're very effective, but they're really no good. And the Hebrews, whenever they wanted to get away from big armies, run up in the hills. And so this was actually true. Do you ever feel like the enemy just picks on your weaknesses and you have to admit, you know, that really is a weakness? And if all you think about is you, and you don't know that God actually uses weaknesses to get bigger things done, it can be pretty intimidating. And finally, he pulls the big one, the real spiritual one. God told me to kill you. That's what he says. God told me to kill you. True or false? False. He's like way overstepped in his, he's lying through his teeth. He's just lying through his teeth. Now, on the other hand, when the Lord does respond to this, the Lord does say, believe it or not, I did send you up there, but you never knew it. You know, so at this point, he's using sheer intimidation against these men, and it sort of works. Verses 11 and 12, Eliakim and Shebna and Joah said to the commander, speak now to your servants in Aramaic. We understand that language, but don't speak in Hebrew, Judean. in the hearing of the people who were on the wall. There's people listening here. Stop saying these things. We want you to use Aramaic. It was an international language. It was similar to Hebrew. But the people on the wall wouldn't be able to understand it. And why would these guys say this? Because they don't want other people to hear what this commander's saying. It's very undermining in terms of confidence. And they don't want to have a revolt on the inside of the wall. And verse 12, so the commander turns up the volume on his PA and he stays with the same language. Has my master sent me only to your master and to you to speak these words and not to the men who sit on the wall, doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? Can you believe that's in the Bible? That's the siege, you see. The sieges were absolutely horrible. And so he's elaborating on it. He's reminding anybody who's ever seen a siege and knows the stories, this is what's going to happen to you. If you trust God, this is what's going to happen. You're going to go down. The commander stood and he cried with a loud voice in Judean and said, hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, don't let Hezekiah deceive you. He will not be able to deliver you, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. By saying the Lord will surely deliver us, this city shall not be given to the hands of the Assyrians. He had done his homework. He knew Hezekiah had said that. He knew that God had promised it, or at least Hezekiah thought so. And he says right flat to it, don't trust God and don't let this guy tell you to trust God. Make a deal with the enemy. That's the only way you're going to survive. He's lying through his teeth. He may have believed it, but can you see the second level of spiritual attack that's going on here against the faith of these people? Do you ever have someone say, well, you know what? I think we should trust God. And there's a little voice inside of you that says, don't listen to that guy. Don't listen to that guy. Your best bet is to disobey God at least just this once. Because, you know, afterwards you can always say you're sorry. And the Lord's really gracious and he'll forgive you. Maybe you can get away with it. Because this time, the only way for you to get out of this is to disobey God. There's nothing new under the sun. This is so, so common. He says, don't let Hezekiah tempt you to trust God. What an odd thing. Verse 16, don't listen to Hezekiah. Thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me, come out to me, and look, I'll give you a deal. Each of you will have his vine and his own fig tree and will drink each of the waters of his own cistern until I come and take you away to a land just like your land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Yeah, you'll be our prisoners, but we promise we'll take you to a really nice place that you'll like. It's like they have little brochures, vacation with the Assyrian. You know, people under their palm trees and having fun, lying in the sun, you know. Can you imagine the leaders of Israel looking at each other going, oh yeah, yeah, right. But that's what he was trying. This is a little temptation thing, like, it makes it look so good to disobey God just this once. It'll be worth it just this once. Verse 18. Now he begins again. He starts to intimidate again. Beware lest Hezekiah mislead you and say the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered this land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Or his land from the hand of... Have the other gods ever done that? No. And of course, that was true. They had wiped out all the other gods. Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of the Shepharvaim? Nobody knows who those guys are. Back then they did. And when have they delivered Samaria from my hand? They had completely destroyed Samaria before this. Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their land from my hand that Yahweh should deliver Jerusalem from my hand now? Now, it's very interesting. He's playing both sides of the religion card. On the one hand, he's saying, Yahweh sent me here, so that's why you ought to do this. And on the other hand, he's saying, I'm actually stronger than Yahweh, and our army is stronger than Yahweh. Typical of a person who just uses religion to get what they want. And so the temptation or the attack comes down from both sides. Now, they do the right thing, verse 21, 22, which is basically not to answer him. They were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, do not answer him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joha, the son of Asaph the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of the commander. So they heard this whole thing. The people on the wall are going, oh. And the three commanders are listening to this whole thing. And Hezekiah had said, do not interact with these guys. You go out there, you hear what they have to say, you hear their deal, which isn't going to be very good. And whatever you do, don't get into it with them. Sometimes, by the way, the best thing to do is just to listen to a person who is laying some heavy temptation or some big attack on who you are as a believer. You're better off sometimes to just sit there and go, are y'all done? Okay, thank you. Thank you for that little piece of your mind that you couldn't afford to lose. You don't have to say that. That's actually interacting. You don't want to interact. But you know what I mean? You just kind of, sometimes the best thing to do is you just nod, even though the person is so full of baloney, it's squeezing out of their ears. And you're looking at them thinking, I can't believe I'm hearing what I'm hearing. And you want with all that is within you to argue with them and put them down and make them see how silly and stupid they are. And there's just no way it's going to work. What's the right thing to do? Turn around and walk away. Because if the Lord's really there, nothing this person is saying or doing is going to matter in the long run, no matter what. And so under this kind of a situation where you are greatly outnumbered and you're in a situation where you know you don't have the weaponry to deal with it, even the mental weaponry, you're racking your brain thinking, I know there's a verse about this. I know I remember something from my apologetics class, and it's just not there. You're reaching all around for the right weapon, and it isn't there. You know, that's okay. If the Lord wanted you to strike somebody dead, you'd have the right weapon. Sometimes he just hides all your weapons because he doesn't want you to say anything. Honestly, I mean, it's kind of weird. And we think, well, why am I getting so many weapons in? I don't know. But sometimes he just wants you to sit tight, let it happen, because there's something bigger that God is doing. And that's what goes on here. So they come back and they've torn their clothes because this is such a frightening situation. They bring it to Hezekiah. King Hezekiah heard it. He tore his clothes. Everybody's tearing their clothes. Covered himself with sackcloth and entered. Now, he does the right thing. He enters the house of the Lord. Now, there was no place else to go. Like I mentioned, the events of chapters 38 and 39 are inverted. If you read chapters 38 and 39, you know that he has actually seen a lot of power that he himself has. He shows it off to the Babylonians. But he knows it's not going to do him any good here. And on top of that, he's already made a huge, huge payment to the Assyrians. He tried to buy them off earlier than this. And they said, thank you very much for the money, and they came after him anyway. So he comes back, and he knows that as far as humans are concerned, nothing is going to happen that'll save him if God doesn't. So he goes to the house of the Lord, the temple. He sent Eliakim, who's over the household, and Shebna, the same guys, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz. In verse 3, and they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this is a day of distress and rebuke and rejection, for children have come to birth and there is no strength to deliver. That's the classic, we're going to die in childbirth idea. Perhaps the Lord your God will hear the words of this commander whom the master of the king of Assyria has sent to reproach the living God. Now see, it's interesting. Hezekiah and his men knew what was really going on here. They knew that they were identified with God, and that because of that, this was a reproach to the real God. This wasn't just them. So notice that Hezekiah has a good theology here. And he realizes what's going on is really not about him, and it's not about his kingdom. It's really about what the Lord wants done and who the Lord is. But he also knows that the Lord sometimes sends his people on suicide missions, and he doesn't want to be one of those. So he's going to ask the Lord, please deliver us. And that's what he prays for. The reproach of the living God, middle of verse 4, and will rebuke the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, offer a prayer for the remnant that is left. Those of us that are left, this is all that's left of Israel, the people in the walls of Jerusalem, pray for us, Isaiah, will you? And don't forget, Isaiah was in there. He's part of them. So I bet he was pretty motivated to pray anyway. Probably already was praying. But when the king says to Isaiah, would you please pray? He's so different than his father Ahaz, you see. Under a similar situation, Ahaz said, forget it, I've made a deal with another military power. And Hezekiah says, nope, I'm going to trust God. We're going to have to pray. The servants of Hezekiah came to Isaiah. And Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. He affirms their concept, their idea. He says, yeah, this is against me, actually. This guy says he can beat me, God says, and I'm not going to let him get away with it. I will put a spirit in him so that he will hear a rumor. He's talking about Sennacherib here. Hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I'll make him fall by the sword in his own land. How sovereign is God over people's lives? Well, this isn't the half of it. Wait till you get to the next section of this chapter. God says, don't worry. I'm going to give him a rumor. He'll get something in his mind about what he's got to do, and he'll have to go home. It reminds me of Obi-Wan Kenobi saying, you don't want to arrest us. And do you guys ever watch those theological works? And the Force, it was like these guys were going, we don't want to arrest you. It's just like this little thing that happens, you know? Lord says, I'm going to let him hear something, and he's going to want to go home. And then he's going to go home, and I'm going to let someone else hear something, and they're going to want to kill him. And then your problem's just going to go away. That's what he says. Verse 8. So then the commander returned and found his king was gone. He went up there. He threw out all this intimidation. So then he leaves. He's got to go down and check with Sennacherib again. They got to find out what's going on at Lachish and so on. Well, what they found out was they had some more battling to do with some other elements. So he's gone for a little while. So what he does is he sends a letter back. When you get a nasty letter, don't you reread it over and over and over again? Is that dumb? But we do. And they send him this letter, and Hezekiah reads it over and over, but then he brings it to the Lord. Watch what happens. He heard that Tirhaka, which is the king of Cush, and an Egyptian ally had moved his army up to engage the Assyrians. It didn't amount to much. It didn't save Israel, but they did come up to engage him. It says, he has come out to fight against you. When he had heard this, he sent messengers to Hezekiah. He was too busy to go back up and yell at Hezekiah anymore. He had to go do war with the Cushite guy, but he sends a letter up. Do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you. Notice how it's gotten a little worse. It was, don't let Hezekiah deceive you about trusting God. Now it's, don't let your God deceive you into trusting him. Saying that Jerusalem shall not be given to the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you've heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands, destroying them completely. You think you're going to be spared? You're reading this in this correspondence, it's diplomatic. It's threatening his life and the life of every person he loves, and they would kill him very, very slowly after killing his whole family in front of him. I mean, this is a serious thing. You think you're going to escape? Did the gods of those nations which my fathers have destroyed deliver them? Gozan, Haran, Rezpah, the sons of Eden. He goes on and lists all these guys. None of these other countries that relied on gods of any sort were able to survive. So he reads this. Look at verse 14. Isaiah then took the letter from the hand of the messengers, read it. He went up to the house of the Lord again, and he spread it out before the Lord. He just takes that thing, and he just lays it out there. Lord, would you look at this? Spreads it out before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed, and he said, Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, you are enthroned above the cherubim. You are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heavens and earth. Now, see, that's different than the other gods, by the way, incidentally. The other gods were all localized. They were the gods of the people. The Hebrew God claimed to be the only God. He said the rest of them aren't real. The rest of the other little mini gods, they all acknowledged each other. But if something that doesn't exist at all, acknowledges another thing that doesn't exist at all, is that an advantage? So, the Hebrew God is the only real one, and he's the creator. None of those other gods were creators, even in their own mythologies. He's the creator God. Incline your ear, O Lord. He uses the covenant name, Yahweh. Incline your ear, O Lord, and open your eyes, O Lord, and see and listen to the words of Sennacherib, who sent them to reproach the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have devastated all the countries in their lands. It is true, Lord. They have done this. Do you ever find yourself reminding the Lord of something in prayer? You're pacing around, you're saying, Lord, you know that we owe this amount of money. You know, and it's going to be, Lord, you know that this physical thing needs to be, you know this, Lord. Do you know this, Lord? It's okay. Did you know it's okay to do that? Almost everybody in the Bible does it. They actually repeat back to God stuff he already knows. Because in the repeating of it to him, we're actually really talking to a real person. He expects us to treat him like a real person, and it's perfectly okay to tell him what's on your mind, even if you know that you're really reminding him of stuff he already knows. But wouldn't you have that kind of conversation with somebody you know, who's a real person sitting there in a chair opposite you? Wouldn't you say, we should review the facts? Sure you would. It's perfectly natural. That's what he does. Truly, Lord, the kings of the Assyrians have devastated all the countries in their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. But Lord, I know they weren't gods at all. They were the work of men's hands, wood and stone. That's why they destroyed them. His theology is perfectly good. He knows who the real Lord is. Now, O Lord our God, deliver us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone, Lord, are the real God. It's for your glory, Lord. I mean, if I die in the process, well, so be it. But he's not saying just save my skin. He certainly wants him to save his skin, but he's really saying glorify yourself in this thing. And I have a hunch, Lord, that those two ideas can go together. My skin can be saved in your glory. But the emphasis is on the glory. Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent word to Hezekiah, and he said this, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. It's like, how refreshing is this? We have a king who actually talks to me about these things and lays it out, not like his father, that idiot who wouldn't even speak to me. I don't know if God calls people idiots. I kind of think he does. I do. The word fool, a fool has said in his heart there is no God, it's similar to the way we use the word idiot. It's a moral thing as much as it is mental. It's a moral twistedness. I think God does do that. Anyway, he says about Hezekiah, you prayed about this thing. That's the right thing to do. Verse 22, this is the word that the Lord has spoken against him. Now, the first verse or latter part of verse 22 is an encouragement to Jerusalem. From verse 23 on, it's a rebuke directly through Isaiah. It's a rebuke to Sennacherib, but Sennacherib doesn't get to hear it. It's spoken in such a way that Hezekiah overhears the curse. So God says, Hezekiah, I'm going to answer your prayer. I'm going to let you in on what I'm saying about Sennacherib. And when you hear what I say about Sennacherib, when I speak to him in this prophetic thing, remember when God speaks, he brings things into existence, and he can also speak things out of existence. So his word, when it is spoken, actually makes stuff happen. So what he's saying, this is a great encouragement to Hezekiah because Hezekiah hears him say something to Sennacherib. So the first part is about Jerusalem. She has despised you and mocked you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She has shaken her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. Now he begins to speak to Sennacherib. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? And against whom have you raised up your voice and haughtily lifted up your eyes against the Holy One of Israel? Through your servants, you have reproached the Lord, and you have said, with my many chariots, I came up to the heights of the mountains in the remotest parts of Lebanon, and I cut down all the cedars and its choice cypresses, and I will go to its highest peak and its thickest forest. This is a metaphor. What it means is, you went to these other nations all around here, and you whacked down all of these nations. Pictures them as a forest. He says, you did all this. And he says, and I dug wells and drank waters. This is the Sennacherib speaking in his own mind. With the sole of my feet, I dried up all the rivers of Egypt. And of course, he had defeated everybody. And now God says, you're missing something, verse 26. Have you not heard? Long ago, I did it. From ancient times, I planned this. Now I have brought it to pass so that you should turn fortified cities into ruinous heaps. And that's why their inhabitants were short of strength, and they were dismayed and put to shame. And they were as the vegetation of the field, as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops is scorched before it's grown up. What they did is they planted, they had flat roofs, right? And they plant them with grass on top. They couldn't make very deep roots, and so it would go bad in the middle of the season. On purpose, they did this. And so he's saying that they had very shallow roots. That's why they seem to be falling before you. But I know you're sitting down, and you're going out, and you're coming in, and you're raging against me. because of your raging against me and because of your arrogance, this arrogance has come up to my ears. Therefore, I'm going to put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I'm going to turn you back by the way you came. It's like, remember when you were a kid and somebody did something really bad to you and they got caught and they got really chewed out and you got to watch? And it felt pretty good because you were vindicated. When you hear God rebuking this horrible enemy, the Assyrians were horrible, even though God used them to wipe out more horrible people. The Assyrians themselves were horrible. So Hezekiah gets to hear God speak to the Assyrians this word of judgment. And do you see what he says? You thought you were doing all this and you're just so full of yourself. Let me tell you, the reason that you won all those fights is because I made sure that the other fighters threw the fight in your direction. That's why they all fell before you. I made sure that the grass was not strong enough to withstand. I made sure that this was taking place because I needed some big creepy power to come down here and wipe out all the idolatry that was down in this lowland, and I used you to do it. And here's Sennacherib thinking he's just like so marvelous. Now, how sovereign is God? Does God use evil to punish evil? When you say, I don't believe in God because of evil, as if evil were somehow more powerful than God. That is not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is that God temporarily allows evil and he uses it against evil. And he even uses it against good in some instances, such as at the cross, to bring about something better, miraculously. That's an answer about evil you will never hear in a philosophy class. I promise. But it's the biblical answer to evil. And you see it consistently in the prophets. And this type of rebuke happens over and over to kings who think they really run the world, and God says, no, you don't. I run the world. And you've been working for me the whole time, and you never knew it. And that is a marvelous, marvelous reminder for us. When we feel like injustice has been done, it probably has. It probably has. But not outside of God's sovereign purposes for a long-term good to everybody who believes and trusts him. And that is a miraculous way of thinking that starts with God and realizes who's really providential and who's sovereign. And this is how Hezekiah is going to be encouraged when his life is on the line, is to know that God is the one who's brought all this about. And it makes you realize, well, if I'm walking with God, then I guess I don't have anything to fear. I might actually die in the process, but I still don't have anything to fear. Exactly. And you know something? That's the theology of the cross. That is the theology of the cross. You see a direct connection between how God told his people to trust him in the Old Testament and the fulfillment of it in the New Testament. Hezekiah, in verse 29, he says, I'll put a hook in your nose. That was what they were famous for, the Assyrians. They put hooks in people's noses and pull them along as their prisoners. And he says, well, I'm going to do that to you, and you're going to go home, back up to back where you came from. Verse 30, he encourages Judah. It will be a sign for you. You shall eat this year what grows of itself, the second year what springs from the same, and the third year sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruit. In other words, you'll live through this, even though you've been under siege, haven't been able to plant, but you will still have enough left over from last year's crop. And the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. It's a great picture. Take root downward and bear fruit upward. That's a great prayer for another person. Help them to take root downward and bear fruit upward. Out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, out of Mount Zion survivors. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he will not come to this city. He's not even going to shoot one of his weapons here. Neither shall he come before it with a shield or throw up a siege mound against it. I promise. He's not even going to do it. By the way that he came, that same way he's going to return, and he will not come to this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend the city and save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. What about for our sake, Lord? I mean, we're here. Would you save it for our sake? He bails them out and they are greatly blessed, but it's for his sake. Boy, we have to remember that. We say, well, Lord, help me. Help me. Bail me out. In his love and in his care and in his grace, he does. He really does. But never forget, it's always for His sake, because we belong to Him. And when He allows something good to happen, it's for His sake, so that we know who He is and other people know who He is. When He allows something bad to happen, it's for His sake. Reasons we don't understand. He says, I'll do this for my sake and for the promise I made to David. It's the right thing to do. And then he commissioned one of his angels to go down and kill 185,000 Assyrian soldiers, and he did it. The angel of the Lord went, struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men arose early in the morning, behold, all of these were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. Now, it's interesting, in Sennacherib's annals, which we know, I mean, there's some records of this. He was quite proud of this whole campaign. It doesn't say in his campaign that he conquered Jerusalem. It says, I closed Hezekiah up like a bird in a cage. And that's all he says about this. He took every other city, and he talks about destroying them and all these horrible things. And he says, and I closed Hezekiah up like a bird in a cage. And then that's the end of the story. Because the Assyrians are famous for never talking about any defeats. But he got this far, the entire Assyrian army, and there was this plum just waiting to be taken. The most important city in the area. And he all of a sudden goes home for no reason? Well, the reason's right here. He lost 185,000 in one night. One angel. Don't mess with angels. Verse 37. Departed and went home. Verse 38, and it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his little g god, that Adrimelech and Sharezer, his sons, killed him with the sword. And they escaped into the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon became king in his place. Exactly what the Lord said would happen. As we look at this, it is a wonderful account. It's one of the most famous accounts in the scriptures. Let me mention, as we close up, some recurring themes in the attacks on our faith. I promise you, in our culture, you look at what happened with the Assyrians coming against Hezekiah, telling him not to trust God. Remember that when our culture tells you not to trust God, makes you feel stupid for being a believer in the real God, that there are some patterns to this that really never change. And see if these don't fit. First, they use this argument, the apparent victory of evil proves that God doesn't exist. Do you notice how these guys said, we are winning. You may think we're bad, but we are winning. And the fact that we have won all this much proves that you can't trust God. And that was the exact argument they used against the Hebrews. There are so many people in our world who use that same argument and tell you not to trust God. Look at all the evil that's out there. If God were really God, why would He allow all that evil? And many people are terribly bothered by this. But you know something, folks? If you will read what He says about evil, I mean, don't try to defend God without appealing to what He actually says. If you read what He really says about evil, He admits it's there. He says it's our fault. And He says He's been victimized by it too and turned it inside out at the cross. Evil is not a problem as long as you read the whole Bible and see what God has done about it. And He says it is temporary. I will use evil. And that's exactly the answer He gives to these people. I'm the one who was in charge of all this quote-unquote calamity as the Assyrians were moving down. You can still trust me. But I'll tell you, that is a major step of faith when you say, I trust God with evil. I trust that He uses evil against evil, and that even when goodness is victimized in the process, my paradigm for understanding unjust suffering of righteous people, my paradigm for understanding it isn't philosophy. It's the cross. And suddenly you realize there is a way to understand it. God brings resurrection out of this unutterable chaos that is planet Earth. And He says, if you come to me, you come to the cross, if you understand what I'm saying, it's not like anything you've ever learned. If you understand what I'm saying, you will realize I can be trusted. That's heavy. That's really heavy. Apparent victories of evil. They do not prove that God doesn't exist. God actually deals with it at the cross. Here's a second way that our faith is attacked. It says this: all religions are essentially the same, but humans have the real power. That's exactly what they said to Hezekiah. Look at all the gods. Now just compare all the gods, and look at all the gods, and look at the fact that none of them really helped at all. Look at all this. Take a comparative religions course if you really want to undermine any faith in God. Because what it does is it takes the human mind, puts it up above all religion, says religion itself is a construct of the human mind, and Christianity is one among many. That's simply not true. There really is a God, and Jesus really came back from the dead. But notice how the attack is the same. The attack is the same. Learn to identify it. It's very tricky. It's very powerful. If you're not awake, that's a very powerful thing. If you go, I've been in church all my life. I'm going to go to college now, and I'm going to take a comparative religions course. And you come out of that kind of going, What happened? Well, they took your brain out, and your faith, they extracted it, and put back faith in what? Faith in the human intellect. And that's exactly what these guys are saying. All the gods are the same, but humans have the power. We have the power. That's what they're saying. That's what they said to the Hebrews. And it wasn't true. God was over it all and saying, shh, listen to me. I'm the one that has the power. You keep trusting me. All religions are essentially the same. Humans have the real power. It's not true. And here's the third kind of thing that they do. They say this, you are alone, and you're going to have to deal with this on your own. You're surrounded, and you're alone, and you're going to have to deal your way out of this without God. And that also is a lie. For anybody who knows the Lord, you are not in this on your own. You do not have to deal with this entirely by yourself. You can take it to the Lord and lay it out before Him, and you can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that He's with you. If you've given your life to Christ and you're part of His kingdom and you understand life from that perspective, that's actually how it works. Isn't it interesting how so many hundreds of years before Christ, the way of faith was challenged just like ours is? And isn't it interesting how that personal relationship in covenant with God was always the answer? Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for reminding us. Our world comes against our faith on a regular basis, in mild forms and sometimes not so mild forms. But we see these patterns just like it was in the ancient times. And we pray that you would grant to us the ability to see, to perceive from your word, through the cross, by the power of the Spirit, understand what your plan is for redemption. That you have dealt with evil ultimately, that you use it only in this world now until you're finished with it, and that you intend fully to vindicate the people that belong to you. And Father, I pray for anybody in this place or within the sound of my voice listening to this study who are facing something right now that they think is absolutely overwhelming, and perhaps the only way to get away from it is to disobey you in some way. And I pray, Father, that they would receive an encouragement from your Spirit right now to continue trusting you, walking forward even though they don't always know exactly where it's going to lead, but taking your hand and knowing it's going to lead to a good place. We pray, Father, that we will think this way in the myriad confusing dilemmas that we find ourselves in, that we will learn to trust you and walk with you like Hezekiah did. Deliver us, Father, from the mistakes and the sins of Ahaz. And teach us, Lord, how to bring it all before you and think this way. We love you, Father, and thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.